Expert HR Weekly, compliance, good practice and benchmarking for UK HR professionals.
Hello and welcome to Expert HR Weekly with me, Bar Huberman. With just 4 weeks to go until we see in the new year, today we're going to cast our minds back and reflect on the most significant changes for HR in 2015. This is the year that saw the election of the first majority Conservative government for the first time in nearly 20 years. But what, if anything, did this mean for employers? Early in the year, there was a big leap for parents and the amount of flexibility they have over how they care for their children in the first year, with the introduction of shared parental leave. We also saw the ban on exclusivity clauses in zero-hours contracts. But now that some time's passed since these changes were introduced, what's the impact been on employers? With me to discuss all this and more is employment law editor Laura Merrides. Good afternoon, Laura.
Hi, Bar.
Okay, so looking back to the first significant change we saw come in this year, with a fair amount of media attention, it has to be said, the introduction of shared parental leave for parents of babies born on or after the 5th of April. It's a subject that we've covered extensively on the site, but could you just remind us of some of the key features of shared parental leave?
Yeah, of course. With the introduction of shared parental leave, and it is a bit of a mouthful and is often referred to as SPL, parents, and we're talking here about both birth and adoptive parents, were provided for the first time with the opportunity to share periods of leave from work during the first year of the child's life. And this could be by either taking it in turns or both being off at the same time.
So can you give us an idea of how that works then?
Yeah, well, provided that a mother meets the eligibility requirements around length of service and earning levels, a mother can bring her maternity leave to an end and take shared parental leave with her partner. But here, it's also provided that the partner meets the eligibility requirements that apply to him or her also.
So how much shared parental leave can parents take?
The amount of shared parental leave that parents can take between them is 52 weeks, but this is minus the amount of maternity leave taken by the mother. Just a reminder, though, that the mother cannot curtail her maternity leave until 2 weeks after the birth of her child, or that's 4 weeks for factory workers, and this is known as the compulsory maternity leave period.
Okay, so it's clear that the aim here was to provide parents with more flexibility and some more options, and in fact parents can choose whether to take SPL in one block or in discontinuous blocks, can't they?
Yeah, that's right. You know, a parent could take a period of SPL, they could then return to work, take a further period of SPL, provided that it's all taken within the first 52 weeks of the child's life.
Now, despite the significant public attention that SPL received at the time it came into force, from what we can tell, the take-up rate doesn't seem that high, does it?
No, I mean, anecdotally, that does seem to be the case. Don't know whether it's a slow burn and rates will increase. It remains to be seen, I suppose. But I think, you know, for our listeners' purposes and as a takeaway from this, I think what's key is the fact that systems will still need to be in place because a request can be made at any time. And to help with that, we've got a full suite of letters and policies on the site which address the various scenarios that can arise.
And we've also got some dedicated podcasts that listeners might find helpful if they want to delve a bit deeper.
Yeah.
But this may not be the end of shared periods of carers' leave. There was an announcement recently by George Osborne that grandparents' leave might be due to come into force soon. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, that's right. It's not actually due to come in until 2018. So, you know, our listeners can breathe a sigh of relief that the systems won't need to be up and running quite as yet. But it is on the cards, and the government has indicated that it intends to start consulting during the first half of next year, so in 2016. We'll keep the site updated as we know more about that.
Okay, so that's something to look out for in 2016.
Yep.
Moving on to the next important change we saw in 2015, the ban on exclusivity clauses in zero-hours contracts. As a first off, Laura, could you just remind our listeners of what a zero-hours contract is?
Yeah, sure. Generally speaking, a zero-hours contract is essentially one where a worker is not guaranteed a fixed number of hours under their contract. But the zero-hours contract can cover a variety of arrangements. I think it's safe to say that as for pay, though, they are only paid for the work which is carried out, and it is worth mentioning that they do also have an entitlement to statutory holidays.
So these contracts offer a fair amount of flexibility for employers. What's the government done about exclusivity clauses then in zero-hours contracts?
Okay, well, on the 26th of May of this year, the government introduced a ban on the use of exclusivity clauses in a zero-hours contract.
And so this means that any clause in a zero-hours contract that prohibits the worker from working under another contract is unenforceable.
Correct. And it also covers the situation of any clause which requires the employer's consent for the worker to work under another contract. So it is an outright ban.
And how will that be enforced?
Well, that was, at least at the time, the unanswered question. And at the time the ban came in, no enforcement procedures had been made. So, you know, in effect, it didn't really have any teeth. However, in October just, we've seen draft regulations being laid before Parliament. And the aim of the draft legislation is to protect workers from any detriment or dismissal that they might suffer as a result of working elsewhere or seeking their employer's consent to work elsewhere.
It sounds as though these regulations are long overdue then. Do we know when they're due to come into force?
No, we don't have an implementation date at the moment, but we will keep listeners informed of developments on that front. But just to add that in the meantime, the government has issued new guidance for employers on the use of 0 hours contracts, and this includes details around their appropriate use and best practice. In terms of the resources that we've got on our site, we've also got a very helpful practical how-to guide, and that can be found under the tools section, and that goes into detail about employing someone on a 0 hours or casual contract and includes material on exclusivity clauses.
Laura, just to wrap up our discussion on 0 hours contracts, there was an awful lot of attention in the press about this earlier this year, and in particular leading up to the election. How much of an impact do you think this ban has had for individuals working under such an agreement?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it did get a fair old amount of media attention. As for the impact, well, it really is just the exclusivity clauses that the government has tackled with this piece of legislation. Some might argue that, you know, how extensive was that in the first place? How many people actually had these clauses in their contracts? So we'll have to see what may come down the line on that front. But at the moment, that is what we're dealing with.
So moving on to the next development we saw this year, and that was the full rollout of the government's Fit for Work service. This had already been available to GPs, but it's now become fully operational for employers too since 8th of September this year, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
And what does it mean for employers? Can you tell us a bit more about it? Is it mandatory? What are the mechanics of it?
Well, it's not mandatory, but it does provide employers with an opportunity to refer an employee for government-funded occupational health advice when that employee has been off work for 4 weeks or more.
Right, so it's an alternative or possibly a further avenue that employers can explore in addition to their own occupational health referral service.
Yeah, that's right. And if an employer chooses to use their own occupational health advisors, you know, or in fact doesn't opt to obtain occupational health advice at all, there isn't in fact an obligation, you know, on that employer to use the government funded service. But it is worth remembering that an employer might find themselves involved with the service anyway, because GPs can refer an employee to the Fit for Work service independently.
So how does that work then?
Well, the government suggests that an employer might want to incorporate any recommendations of the Fit for Work service either into their own advice if they've obtained it, or indeed take it on if they haven't taken on any advice at all. But again, all of this is non-obligatory, it's non-mandatory.
That's interesting. So it's basically an option available to employers, but it isn't mandatory. What if the employer wants to refer, but the employee refuses, they don't want to be referred?
Yeah. Well, again, the employee cannot be forced to participate in a Fit for Work service referral. They also have to consent. But in those circumstances, an employer may then need to take any decisions in relation to that employee without the benefit of any occupational health input. And of course, that may not be in the employee's best interests.
So it does sound like Fit for Work has its potential uses, perhaps in particular for smaller employers. Let's take a look at the last significant piece of employment legislation introduced this year then. Just over a month ago, on the 29th of October, we saw the introduction of the Modern Slavery Act 2015. Many people will have heard about it, but they might be confused by what it in fact means for employers and HR. So can you tell us a bit more about it?
The purpose of the legislation is to attempt to tackle the problem of modern slavery. And by modern slavery, we mean forced or compulsory labour, servitude or human trafficking. It may not be immediately apparent to, you know, our UK employers that this is an employment issue, but it does have implications, particularly for larger employers who use supply chains.
So how large do employers have to be in order to be captured by the legislation?
Well, under Section 54 of the Act, it needs to be a commercial company with a total turnover of at least £36 million per year.
Okay, so that's set the parameters, but what will companies who meet this threshold be required to do?
Well, they'll need to provide a slavery and human trafficking statement for each financial year, and the statement will need to detail the steps that the organisation has taken to tackle human slavery within their organisation, or the fact that they have, in fact, taken no steps.
Well, I can imagine that providing a statement saying they've taken no steps doesn't sound like a very attractive option. I doubt it would be great for a company's reputation, and presumably there might be a commercial downside.
That's it. I mean, there is a risk there, and organisations may well take the view that it's not a position that they want to take.
So this is going to be completely new territory for many of our listeners. What can they do to prepare?
Well, the government has recently issued guidance for employers, and we have links to this on our site, together with our own resources, of course, and in particular some useful FAQs. Perhaps as a starting point, employers need to review their business model and supply chain to identify areas of risk. You know, look at any policies that may be in place or could be introduced to prevent human trafficking. Start taking any steps which they consider to be necessary.
And for those who want to find out more, do have a look at our new model anti-slavery statement, which we've just this week published. So we've already mentioned that the legislation was passed in October, but when do employers have to provide the anti-slavery statement?
There is still a bit of time, as although the legislation is now in force, the requirement to provide a statement actually only applies to financial years ending on or after the 31st of March of next year, so that's 2016. The government's guidance states that they would encourage employers to publish their statements as soon as reasonably practicable, and the government goes on to say that in fact that they would encourage organisations to report within 6 months of their financial year end.
So employers do have some time to comply with this requirement, but they really should start looking at it now and start preparing.
Yeah.
Well, that brings us to the end of our roundup of employment law changes in 2015. Thank you, Laura, for providing an interesting update of where things stand at the end of the year. If you want to find out more, head to our audio and video tool, where you'll find a link to our webinar on the A to Z of legal changes in 2015 and 2016. Do also join Susan Dennehy and I for our New Year podcast, when we'll be discussing the employment law changes affecting HR in 2016. All that's left is for me to say thank you for listening to Expert HR Weekly. We're back next Friday with another episode, but until then, it's goodbye from us.
Expert HR Weekly, the latest from experthr.co.uk, the award-winning subscription service for HR professionals.